And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started. Patti Quatro, I can't believe it's only the beginning of 1968, and we ended the last episode with Frank Sinatra's Fly Me to the Moon, because you quoted the lyrics and reflected upon that they were so apt for your feelings about what was happening to the pleasure seekers. I mean, you were signed to Mercury Records. You must have been to the moon. Tell me.
It was, but that's exactly how I felt. I mean, Frank Sinatra, who could say it better, you know? That's how I was feeling with the footholds that we were gaining, you know, another step up the ladder and the momentum going for the band. It was magic, you know?
Absolutely. And I recently, for the listeners, I posted the picture of all of you signing with Mercury. And yeah. There were a lot of comments, and I agreed with all the comments that, Patti, you have a smile on your face that you can see you're the band leader. You can see that this has been your epiphany and it's coming to life. I mean, it makes me so emotional. Everybody else is smiling, but there is a difference, a je ne sais quoi, with your smile that you just, I don't know if you remember that moment, but talk to me about it.
It was a happy day. That was so exciting. Leo looked so cute in the picture, so serious and signing. You know, he really was all about the business, you know. A lot of stuff that you and I talk about conversationally, Leo, he didn't get involved in that stuff. He really was a businessman. And he took that thing and ran with it and got us signed. And it was amazing. It was an amazing day.
Well, he's a talented businessman and manager, and your father chose wisely to pick him as your manager. And so all of this is unfolding. I mean, this is so high speed because in addition to signing with Mercury Records, you continue to play up and down the East Coast as well as Canada. It was nonstop bookings because of ABC and Joe Glazer. Plus, you're building this reputation now and popularity as a band. So just to, give you a little more itinerary from, we're not sure of the date, March to March 31st, 1968. You played again in Miami Beach, Florida, but this time not at Trudy Heller's nightclub. You played at another nightclub called Jilly's. And so, Patty, tell us who Jilly was and about his nightclub.
Jilly was a very it, his club was a very popular club in Miami, very popular. And he was, wait for it, a mobster. I mean, he definitely was a real nice guy. He treated us fine, but he was a mobster. It was near the waterfront, and a lot of movie people hung out there and all that. And it was a very nice club, very, very nicely set up and all that. And I'm sure we heard about Jilly from somebody in the club, I mean, again, Joe booked it, so there you go, he had his connections.
Those mob connections, it really was a continuum of the music in the mob. So I want you to tell us now, not only were there mobsters there, that was probably a given with Jilly, but like Trudy Heller's, you had some spectacular guests, or as you would call them, the glitterati, who frequented Jilly's. And so you're now literally playing amongst the stars. And so I would like you to talk about who was there, not just at Trudy Heller's or Trick now. So tell us.
Well, this story is important because we were actually filmed. It was Frank Sinatra and Mia, this quiet and meek, she was a sweetheart, and Raquel Welch, who was much shorter than I realized, voluptuous Raquel. She was in the movie. They were filming Lady in Cement, which is one of Frank's movies. And they were doing it whenever they could, So we're all hanging out, and Richard Conte was in the movie, and they wanted to have us in the movie. So we filmed it and everything. And
Wait,
Leah.
let me interrupt for 1 second because I want to set the stage as I like to. They wanted you to be in the movie playing live in Jilly's.
Yes. Exactly,
Okay.
exactly. And we, of course, we were excited to do it. We were all for it. And Leo went along with it until he realized that it was going to be sort of a sleazy club scene, within the movie. And he had a little fit afterwards, after it was all done. He said, no. That's not good for our image. We don't want to be seen in that kind of a scene. So what they did was our drums are in the freaking movie, and they didn't use the parts that we had filmed. So that was pretty disappointing. But Roy was always protective of our mystique. That I'm not surprised.
I know I would love to credit my dad, Roy, here, but I think you mean Leo. This Roy had not come into the picture yet. So when you're saying Leo Fenn was protective of you, correct?
Yes, Leo Fenn. And any other manager would have said, oh, leave him in. This is great.
Well,
It's
I was just going to say, look, I
oh.
love my dad with all of my heart, and he, yes, would go on to manage you in 73 and 74 and 75, so a different era. But this to me is the difference between Leo Fenn and my dad, Roy Silver. And I don't mean to isolate my dad on this. I would say many managers. I think Leo was the unique one in this because we can look back now and say he made the right decision, but you were an up-and-coming band. This could have been the most amazing, quote-unquote, opportunity for you. Who knows? But that he was steadfast in this mystique that he had of the pleasure seekers and that he did not want you to be seen in a sleazy bar. So I give him a lot of kudos for that.
I do too. He was unique. He was unique in the way his belief was. Darlene always said that. He created and wanted to hold that mystique and not have us be running around like every other rock band,
Well, and also running around like the few girl rock bands that were there, because
Yeah, we'll get to
that.
that.
Yeah, but also that would have come, he was smart enough. That could have really ruined your reputation.
Yeah,
as well, in terms of even on the insiders. So obviously the feedback from the glitterati at Gilly's was fantastic. I don't think Frank Sinatra would agree to let you be in the film had he not thought you were all wonderful. So did you chat with Frank Sinatra and Mia Farrow?
Yeah, we all hung out there and stuff. There would be scenes when they were filming, you know. I mean, we slept a lot during the day, but they had to film when they could and everything. It happened. We had that one dinner that you have the picture of where Richard put the make on Susie. Oh my God.
Richard Conti, by
Richard Conti.
the
Yes. She's smiling, but she was like, oh my God, get your arm away from around me. You know, he was like leaning right over her, you know.
And you can see that in the picture. And for those who don't know who Richard Conti is, he's an old school actor. You can look him up and
Yes. Oh my God.
well, at the same time that all of this is happening, you get asked, you're in Miami still, and you're asked to be on the John Gary TV show, which was a nationally syndicated TV show. And so I just want to clarify something because this is many episodes ago. You had mentioned that some of you in the Pleasure Seekers were dancers on a local TV show in Detroit called Swingin' Time, but that was different than you actually performing as the Pleasure Seekers. So, how did this come about? Tell us about the show and the performance, and were there other bands playing? I'm curious.
No, there were no other bands on it. He had a guest list. I'm trying to remember who was on the show with us, but we were the band that was going to play. And I remember it was our edu boy, did we get taken to school in the idea of makeup ladies and how they presented you on TV. Because they put us in this garish red lipstick. And when we saw it back later, the clip, we were like, oh my God, we look like whores because they had this deep red lipstick. We were so pissed. But it was a national show. I mean, yeah, they had heard about us and they wanted us on. We were quite the thing in Miami at that time. People knew about us, word of mouth, you know.
Mouth, which gets me to the next thing that was happening in Miami.
Oh my
This
God.
is, it's to
Oh.
me equal parts hilarious, but also so insightful. And it's a magazine article. And this is in March, also in Florida. And Arlene, your sister, Foxy Lady, was featured on the cover of a magazine called My Son, the magazine, Sun being spelled S-U-N because it was a Sunday magazine that included an interview and quite the photo spread, which we also have pictures of. And it's far too long to read, Patty, here. So I will post it for everyone, but I do want to give everyone a taste of the tone of the article. So let's cut to the chase and just say that this anonymous author, okay, this person, I'm assuming it's a man, but I don't want to, this anonymous author is known as, quote, my son. And my son was clearly head over heels in love with your sister, Arlene. But before I begin to read a little bit, I'm just curious, Patty, why was Arlene featured besides the obvious that she's gorgeous, but all of you are gorgeous? Why was that decision made not to feature the whole band in this very long expose, actually?
Well, all you had to do was take a look at her, and I understand why he fell in love and wanted to interview her. You know, I mean, that was the kind of attention she got. That was, I'm telling you, she was like the Pamela Sue Anderson of her era, and just a beautiful blonde, and her outfit was just fabulous. I mean, the spread was huge. A
It
lot
was.
of pages in the magazine. Who does this? You know, they put a girl from a band on the cover of the Sunday magazine, and this is Miami,
It's
not
not even, it's not
Chicago,
even,
Illinois. You know,
or
I
not even Detroit, local girls, you know, this is Miami.
jeez.
Well, I just, okay, so here is what my son wrote. Here's a couple paragraphs. First of all, it's titled, quote, Blue-Eyed Soul Girl.
Oh, God.
And I thought that was funny also because I don't know if it was a tie-in with Frank Sinatra's blue-eyed, you know, whatever, but I don't know if that connection was made. But blue-eyed soul girl, he goes on to write, a girl apostle of blue-eyed soul. He goes on to say something that Patty, you and I talked about briefly, and it really threw me in a way where I thought this is a topic that I don't think has been pursued because female bands were not the norm the way rock bands were. But he opens up the article and says, Boy fans don't scream like girls, they die.
God.
I thought, okay, what is he getting with? So then he goes on to describe, and I'm quoting here, quote, "When she walks down the street, horns honk, cars slow up, passerby grin their secret grins, and Arlene Fenn just wanders on, used to it all and unperturbed. Sometimes a curious one is bold enough to stop Arlene and ask her who she is and what she does. Her answer, like her mod traffic stopping clothes, makes mouths drop open." And so before you had said, before I go on, that you said this happened with Arlene all the time.
Yes, she got that kind of attention, guys standing in front. You got to remember when Arlene, and this was on the street, but when she would play, she had from her dancing passion, she married with that keyboard. I mean, you would have thought it was one entity. Her movement while she was playing. I don't know another girl in another girl band that presented like Arlene was able to. So she was known for that. And I'm not surprised all the action she got. Not at all.
Well, I love that marriage between her dancing and her piano playing, because she did get to bridge those talents. But so the author says, what's the response when walking down traffic in her mod looking outfits? And she says, very blasé, "I'm a pleasure seeker." And then it goes on to say, ever since they became the pleasure seekers, the group of girl singers for whom she plays the organ and harmonizes have loved to see people's mouths drop open when they tell them that. They work at Jilly's. And here's where, again, this guy, my son, I mean, I hope he's embarrassed if he's still alive when he goes back. This is like hagiographic or just downright kind of creepy. He goes on to say, and he's talking in the third person, okay, because he's the one writing it and his anonymous name is my son. He says, quote, "On the day she met with my son, the interviewer, to explain why blue-eyed soul is becoming a big thing in the music world, she was dressed in roughly white from ankles to earlobes. Under each eyebrow, there was a long, thick stroke of arching white. Eyelashes were drawn in black and white around her eyes and big as badminton netting." Close quote. It then goes on to say, my son went all to pieces immediately, thinking of all the money he was losing because he couldn't rent her out along the Amazon River as a white goddess. Close
Oh,
quote.
my God.
Okay, in today's world, that would just be like that. This would be too much cancel culture. It'd be like, all right, creep. But going back to 68, I just would like you to clarify something here. I mean, teasing aside, but what did he mean when he said blue-eyed soul sound is becoming a big thing?
You know what? I'm going to have to defer and go a little introspective here because there's so many angles about what you just read. Okay, you are blue-eyed soul. No, that is not what we were. It was just a common term. But think about what you're doing here, the beginning point of all this stuff coming out with this girl bands and girls and how they're perceived and all that. Remember who we're brought up by? My daddy. And how he taught us to present everything on the stage, right? Costuming, movement, the musicality, all of it. I don't know, and I'm not taking credit here, but I don't know another girl band that was stepping onto that ladder so heavily as we were. Goldie, New York, R&B, us. Think about what we were doing. We grabbed the male mentality. That's what we were doing. We were doing the rock male mentality, and that's what we were passionate about in our music. So I'm not surprised that this article was almost like a birthplace of what was going on between male bands, and all of a sudden, here come the girl bands. And nobody was doing it like we were. The other girl bands, we talk about the tent, okay? The white tent and all the women. There were so many women picking up instruments and say, hey, I can do that, and blah, blah, blah. but not the same way as what the pleasure seekers grabbed onto, this male aesthetic of heavier rock. That's what we were doing. So, of course, we got noticed. And Arlene, oh my gosh, she was the epitome of that, combining her sexuality with this whole thing. You know, male bands had just as hard of a time as girl bands did. They did. You know, all the suits and the people that were running the studios and everything, they were trying to figure all out how to market each band, the male or female. It wasn't gender-based, but all of a sudden, here it was. Yeah.
Well,
Okay. Now we have women in the mix. And
I
it was.
think Patty, what you're saying is so fascinating because it's also there had already for about a decade at this point, rock and roll had been mainstream for male bands.
Yes.
Now they're having to take a journalistic, like a language, and how to cross over to write about rock and roll with women playing it.
Yes.
Mick Jagger was hot. It's not like they weren't, dealing with their sexuality. It was just the language had to shift.
And you know what's so funny? Again, this article has made me go so introspective about it. We all were, you know, we're young teenagers finding our way, right? I can't tell you through the decade, okay, that we existed, how many times I was written about. And the thing they would pick up on is my long legs. That was the sexuality thing that they wanted to write about. Nancy got written about. Susie did. Arlene did. You know, all of that was going on in that era. And it was a new thing for the writers. But yeah, they went to town. But they were always respectful to us. And they always were talking about the music. And that was a side thing. Yeah, they're great to look at too. So we were blessed with our press through a decade. I'm telling you, it always shocked me. And yeah, it could have gone to our heads, you know, but it didn't, because they always married it up with the fact that we could freaking play, you know?
That's absolutely. Well, and it's interesting because the anonymous interviewer, my son, he does, even though he continues to obsess over Arlene's looks, your sister, because she's also your daddy's daughter, your sister was so clever in her answers because she was able to turn the article right around. So the next part of the article reads, quote, "When will a girl band make it really big?" And then again, this is April 68. And he asks Arlene, what was life like for you before you be I'm sorry. I'm so excited. What was life like for you before you became a pleasure seeker? And Arlene says, she's so cute to me. Every Monday, I was a big flunk off at the office. I wouldn't go into work just on Mondays. Tuesdays, I'd come back. And all the girls would yell to the boss, how come she gets away with that? And she adds, I quit to get married. And then in parentheses, it reads, her husband is Leo Fenn, manager of the Pleasure Seekers, close quote. And then he adds, my son adds, does it hurt your sex appeal for fans that you're married? And this is Arlene, I just love her. She says, hurt it. And then she says to Leo, which is funny that this interviewer is saying all of this in front of Leo. Right? She goes, hurt it to Leo, which means he was there. Should I tell him about the time we were in New York and this writer who had about 15 hits at the time, this real nut job for blondes? He says, you're beautiful. I love you. He must have apologized for the next hour. He's a complete gentleman. Close quote. So before we go on, do you know who the songwriter was she was talking about?
No, it's in the rock ether. There's so many writers in our history.
Yeah, but who had 15
Oh,
hits in 1968? That's where we need to.
I have a stack in my archives of magazines that have featured us through the decade. It's great. They just kept coming back to that birthing point.
Yes,
I mean, we were 1964.
yes.
God,
But
no.
this is where, again, your sister, like you, because of being Art Quattro's kids, she
Yeah.
totally then turned it around again because after she talks about no, it didn't hurt her that she's married with all the male guys or the fans, she goes on to say, quote, but our ambition, we want to become the first all-girl band to have a hit record, really rock the world. And then your
Yeah.
sister goes on to say, Goldie and the Gingerbreads were the only ones Close quote. So I just, again, I talk about any of this, but I think that what you were saying before, Patty, is clearly you were very well seasoned in giving interviews and how to put yourself out
Yes.
there and also cleverly turn the conversation around to get what you want out of the interview.
Okay. Here I go, introspective again, because this really floors me, this magazine. It really does. It was a very clever analysis Arlene gave, and it's so true. Now you gotta realize who you're talking about, these Detroit girls that grew up in the magic of Detroit. I've spoken in previous episodes about the magic of Detroit and how I got taken to school in LA with the malice of LA. You know, that all comes up through time and decade. And I never in my life in Detroit with my band members, okay, we did not think in the terms that I recognized later in the decade. The girls were passionate about the music. I was so blessed with the women I had in my band. I'll never get over that, how blessed we were to be about that instead of like in LA, it was like, I just want to be famous. I
Yeah,
just
exactly.
want to be famous. And some of the girls I worked with there, it was just, you know, sick. It was like, that's what you're after. And then, you know, other women I worked with out there were so much like me and my girls from Detroit, and we just wanted to play music, and that was the motivation, not the I want to be famous bullshit. There was such a difference, and Arlene got it. You know, what she was talking about was right from her heart. She just wanted to play her music and get a hit record and have fun with it and follow her passion. And she was being so honest and truthful. And that's who she was, you
Well,
know?
and as you said, to add to that, and not to, I mean, everything you're saying is so right on, but also this could have all gotten to your heads. You're young, you're impressionable,
Yes.
and it doesn't seem like it. And so, yeah, after your sister gives this amazing answer about we want to be the first, my son, again in air quotes, the anonymous interviewer says, quote, "Goodness, you're forgetting Phil Spitalny and his all-girl orchestra," close quote. And I laughed to myself when I read that because I thought, clearly this guy does not know that Arlene is the daughter of Art Quattro, who would have, he would have known that, she would have known that. But also, it made me laugh. But as she says, she goes on, which I loved, your hipster Arlene sister says, quote, "Huh?" And then she goes, "Oh yeah, but that was a different bag than what we play. I mean, nobody's ever made it in the rock world, and it's going to be hard because girls make and buy more records than guys, and they scream and go nuts over guys more than they go nuts over girls. So it's got to be a good sound," close quote. And
Exactly.
I'm underscoring that last part because it speaks to what you were saying, but I do think there's now a larger picture within the rock world that's happening, which is that they understand that it has to be talent and timing and the music. You can be the best band in the world, but if you don't have the right material that hits in that certain moment, that go ahead.
Think about it. This was. I always title it this way. This was a Renaissance era. Okay. Everybody knows classic rock. I mean, I don't think it'll ever happen again. But you had that British invasion. You had the punky R&B of New York, the Southern, the acid rock, the Northern rock, you know. And here we were. I mean, we were attaching to all of that and more. And jeez, it's so obvious to me what was going on. Everybody trying to make it with a hit record and all that, the marketing, everything. I mean, there were bands. How many one-hit wonders can you name from England that we all know and love? But they had like one hit, but they got so famous off it. Well, they had a damn good team behind them that really PR'd them right and everything. It took all of it in the pot to get that hit record. It wasn't easy, not only for women, but for men too. It was a hard thing to do. But, you
I want to add to that because
know.
there, I think it can be formulaic, right? In terms of the music biz during this time of how to market, all the suits are there. If we do this, if we do this, and girl
Yes.
fans and boy fans and all of that. Even then, it still
Even
doesn't mean
then.
you're going to make it. And I love the fact that all of the press, and I'll finish with this article, and I want to get to one more because there really are far too many to cover all of them. But I think that that's what I am loving about the pleasure seekers is you all had your heads on straight in terms of what you knew the biz to be, what your pursuits were in terms of being top-notch musicians. You were not little models trying to pull it off, and you weren't doing it for the fame. You were doing it to create music. And so,
Pleasure dad, a credit dad, credit dad,
absolutely.
our upbringing. Yep.
And also Leo Fenn, who's his son-in-law, as
Yes.
well as Arlene's husband at the time. And so, but I do want to, there's another aspect we've been talking about. We talked about it on the previous episode with your male groupies or gropies and how they became grabbers. And I thought your sister Arlene, this was just so telling to me, and I would love your thoughts on it when I'm done reading it. So again, clearly my son, the interviewer, was just gaga over your sister. But she says, which I thought was really interesting, it says, or my son says to her, "Why is it that boys don't wear bobby socks and faint when girls are singing?" And then he says, "What's the explanation of that?" And
Oh,
Arlene
God.
so funnily answers, quote, "Guys, hey, guys act sillier than girls. You wouldn't believe it. They say, 'I love you, I love you.' Why, one guy at a place I played, I thought he was dead. I thought he was dead. I couldn't even look at him. He just stayed like that 3 hours. He didn't move."
Oh, my God. Oh,
Close
my
quote.
God. So true, that would happen. Oh my God, the guys acted so funny. Oh. They evolved, you know. This was the birthplace of all this, 1964 on through the pleasure seekers. And yeah, we had all that.
The
We
Bobby
had all that. The
Soxers.
guys were hilarious. They would stand at the front and just, oh.
I love that. Well, I mean, I've loved reading from this article. And again, we just read snippets of it. It's endless. But I want to pick up because it's a perfect bookend of everything we've been talking about, Patty, which is there's an article. It was a short article that was written in a magazine called Cashbox. And for those who don't know, it's a music magazine for music insiders. So it's a very different language in terms of who they're appealing to and trying to get information out. And this too is from April 1968. And again, it's too long, but I'm going to read it in part. So it reads, "Pleasure seekers. The pleasure seekers are beautiful, both musically and physically. If they didn't have talent, they could work on the strength of their looks alone." Close quote.
Oh,
But
my
here's the important part for me. Again, this is a Music Insider magazine.
yeah.
It says, quote, "But they do have talent. In fact, they play and sing with more power than most of the new male groups around. All girl groups have appeared on the scene before, but none has made a lasting impact. Most of them lack a solid musical base. The pleasure seekers have such a base, and given the right material," there's that idea again, they could go all the way," close quote. So, Patty, I mean, this is just such an important idea. That you could have all the elements of being signed to a label, having the right manager, having the looks, everything, and all the money behind it. It doesn't mean you're going to make it, but I'm just fascinated by this idea and that you as a band understood that you had to have that crossover.
You had to. I had a record label laughing with me one time. He said, "You know, these people come in and they want to be, you know, they're a legend in their own mind." And a lot of times the bands would get like that. Their egos would take over. And as Nita Strauss says, ego trumps talent. Yeah. I mean, it's so true. We were brought up in the way my dad did, that, you know, it was about the music, and we loved it. We were educated in that. So this was a normal feeling for us. And the press was so friggin' kind to us all through that whole trades area when we signed with Mercury. It was good press after good press after good press. People were excited, this girl band that could actually play and the whole thing. And they never put us down because we were nice looking. It didn't happen, which was very cool, you know, that they kept it very straight and above board about the talent and what we were doing on stage. I mean,
Yes. And you
credit
know
to
what?
them, yeah.
And looks matter, whether you're a male band or a female band.
Absolutely.
But I, again, they always made sure to anchor your looks with your talents. And so
Yes.
I want to finish this because this speaks to exactly what you're saying. It's also really cool to read this print because you and I have spoken about this and now they're acknowledging it. It says, on Wednesday night, April 10th at Arthur's, which is a nightclub, and we're going to talk a lot more about Arthur's in a little while, the Pleasure Seekers tested their mettle against some of the biggest tunes of the day. They opened with a rousing version of the Beatles' Magical Mystery Tour and went on to perform a number of the songs from the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's LP, winding up with A Day in the Life, which we discussed before, Patty. I just thought that was so cool. It goes on to read, quote, both their vocal and instrumentals, three guitars, organ, and drums, sounds are strong and professional, and their movements are well rehearsed and effective, exhibiting more energy than can reasonably be expected of five young women. The Pleasure Seekers entered the R&B and Motown bags and gave powerhouse readings to Try a Little Tenderness, Stop in the Name of Love, and Reach Out, I'll Be There. Another highlight of the evening was the group's performance of the Bee Gees hit To Love Somebody. It concludes with, having recently signed a contract with Mercury Records and with their first Mercury single due out immediately, the Pleasure Seekers are now in a position to test themselves against the general public. The group is right, and if the song is too, watch out. Close quote. Patty, come on, I just got chills.
That was what the trades were giving us. It was an amazing time, and we were blessed that we were getting that kind of recognition. And those things, those magazines go through the nation. I mean, it just, upped the ante quite a bit. People are reading that stuff, so it's no wonder the word got around, and we played it like a fine fiddle. We were happy to take advantage of this wonderful press and very appreciative.
have somebody.